Welcome to Political Rewind. It's 2:06 on a Wednesday afternoon, and as always, we are live in the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting Radio, and we have so much on our plate to talk about today. The last 24 hours have been rather remarkable. I think most people will agree. The memorial service in Dallas for the slain police officers, attended by both President Barack Obama and President George Bush and their families, to hear, and you've all heard the sound by now, to hear President Obama and George W. Bush each give really moving speeches about the need for unity, about the way to find peace in the black community, to find peace among the law enforcement community, to find a way for people to start working together, I think gives us an awful lot to digest and talk about in the beginning minutes of the show today. A little bit later, we'll be talking about what's going on in Cleveland as the platform committee meets up there to hammer out a platform before the Republican convention starts on Monday, and Jim Galloway will be filing a report for us from up there. But and we'll talk, too, of course, about Bernie Sanders endorsing Hillary Clinton. But to start the conversation, we have with us, very glad to welcome back, former Democratic Congressman Buddy Darden, Cobb County man for most of his life. It's great to have you back here in the studio with us, Buddy.
I'm so glad to be back. I've been laid up for the last couple of weeks and watching a lot of TV, 24-hour news cycle, and I'm ready to go, Bill.
Excuse me. I'm glad to hear that, Buddy. And our very special guest, the Reverend Gerald Durley, a longtime civil rights leader in this community, a faith leader, former senior pastor, retired senior pastor of Providence Missionary Baptist Church, one of the great churches in metro Atlanta. Leo Smith from the Georgia Republican Party just sent us a text saying he is on his way. So he will be, the Georgia Republicans will be represented on today's show. But as we wait for Leo to arrive, Reverend Durley, let me start with you. Just give me your feedback as you watched President Obama and George W. Bush make their very impassioned pleas for finding a path toward unity yesterday.
I was very moved by both of the speeches that were shared. And I think America has reached a very critical point, a critical point where the nation has already been divided by red and blue and black and white and tall and gay and lesbian and all these divides. And anyone of consciousness, and I think both men have that, they had to begin to talk about how do we begin to come together. In other words, I think what they were trying to do was set a stage for communication, which has now been, and this country has divided. And for communication to exist, there has to be three principles. And I think we found that in both of their speeches. One, we have to begin to understand each other. They talked about the understanding between the policemen and those that were protesting and others. So in order to communicate and start that ground of coming together, it had to be communication. Next, I think that they both demonstrated an amount of respect, where the respect between the two of them was apparent, which sends a message to America, is that we might have differences, but we certainly have to respect each other. So if communication is to exist, we have to understand each other, respect each other. And that leads to the big bugaboo in communication where the breakdown had occurred, and that is we must trust each other. You cannot trust someone that you don't understand nor respect. So consequently, I think both speeches began to talk about how do we begin to understand each other's differences, how to respect each other's differences, and then possibly a level of trust. And hopefully that will permeate the kinds of divisiveness that's going on throughout the country.
Such a tall order. Buddy, the symbolism of George W. Bush, the Republican former president, and the Democratic current president standing together in that memorial service yesterday. And for that matter, the fact that the president invited and Ted Cruz accepted an invitation to fly on Air Force One to Dallas. Here's one of the president's toughest critics, and there's no question that President Obama doesn't have any love lost for Ted Cruz. But that, too, a great moment of symbolism, I think.
Bill, it was most impressive. In addition to, of course, the former chief executive and the current president being there, their spouses were there, too. And I'm a big admirer, by the way, of Laura Bush. I think that she was a wonderful first lady, and I think probably one of the most underrated people ever to be in Washington. But yesterday reminded me of this, that there are some things bigger than politics, and we've got, as much as we love politics and as much as it's a great hobby and it's a great avocation for so many of us, at the same time, our lives can't be defined by politics. They've got to be things above and beyond and more important and more significant, including the humanity of man toward man and coming together, communicating, as he was saying. And so politics is important, yes, but we've got to remember that politics is not an all unto itself. It is simply a means by which we are able to carry out some of our principles and ideas, but it certainly is not an end. And so we've got to start, in my opinion, getting back to the basics and remember the proper role of politics. It's not an end-all, be-all.
We've been here before. And by the way, Leo Smith has just joined us. Thank you for being with us, Leo.
It's good to be with you all. And good to see you, buddy. Good to see you, Reverend Durden.
We're going to continue, and I want you to weigh in as you hear us talk, Leo. You know, we've been here before. Is this really all just rhetoric? Reverend Durley, you have been involved. You were this past week during demonstrations here in Atlanta, Black Lives Matter demonstration at the Center for Civil and Human Rights. You had like 10,000 people who turned out, and you spoke to the crowd in a very impassioned and eloquent way. But what do we do? What's the next step? Let's just start with a community like Atlanta, where you have mistrust between the Black community and the police force. What do we do to really make a difference?
Well, I think, first of all, as I said earlier, it starts, as everyone has said around the country, it starts with communication. That brings a level of awareness. One of the things that made us strong, I think, in the civil rights movement were three different positions that we took. We organized, we strategized, and we mobilized. Right now, you can't mobilize in a definitive way because we don't have that real strategy that you're referring to. So this is the organizational phase. I think to move toward a strategy, we have to have that community where I can begin to respect the differences in our opinion and how do we find a common bond. The young people out in the street, they want to have their messages heard. So we've got to understand what is that message. It was around police brutality, but I think it was around much larger than that. It was about an unjust system that kept people in a box. Those were the feelings that were coming out. So right now, it's a matter of how do we channel that energy. And the way that I channel that energy, there were four things that kept us strong at one time, I believe, in this nation. One, we used to, if you got in a fight, you called the police. You trusted the police. That's very difficult to do right now. You trusted your teachers. Even now, it's difficult to trust teachers. You even trusted the home life. But right now, our homes are becoming apart. And finally, you trusted the church. But we are under so much scandal. So when those four things begin come apart, we've got the kind of situation we have. So now we've got to go back, going toward what you're talking about, a strategy. We've got to have where the church, the family, the educational system begin to work together. And that starts with when we bring the awareness first that it's not there, then begin to talk. Those are the steps that we've got to take now.
Well, let me open this. Go ahead, Leo.
It's so wonderfully said. I mean, I actually was listening to the Reverend talk about the importance of communications on the way in and the importance of trust. One of the elements that breeds trust is a mutually beneficial exchange, not only of information, but of result. And when people see an inconsistency in results delivered, if they see that they're communicating one way but never getting any result that they want, they get frustrated. That's how apathy grows. That's when they withdraw. Then, of course, their problems are never met. Their condition becomes worse. Then they charge out at you. They fight. We see things like Dallas. We see things like 75 being blocked, those kinds of things. So we got to deliver substance. The substance come from getting beyond the emotional immediate response, which everybody has to have those moments. Kasim Reed is doing a good job of saying, okay, we understand this is emotional, so let's get past and beyond that. Now let's start to get into the halls of power and start to strategize with people who can actually make a change in policy that can lead to a better ecosystem for justice-driven legislation and execution of police work in a way that benefits everyone. Now the communication manifests into improving one's life. Now, the strategy piece is where we generally lack effort. We lack work. And so even tonight, we're having a work session with our Attorney General, Sam Olens, with the Georgia Center of Opportunity. That's not as sexy.
Who's we?
We meaning a couple of, I mean, it just happens to be people who are concerned about social justice issues, concerned about police brutality, concerned about issues in urban communities or any communities where people are losing their lives. But we don't do it in the traditional social justice civil rights way. We don't march. We don't protest. We are first vice chairman of the Georgia GOP, Michael McNeely, former police officer, African-American. Leo Smith, former NAACP leader, former Equal Opportunity Affirmative Action leader at Virginia Tech, works with the Georgia Republican Party, Attorney General Sam Olens. You got Eric Coughlin from the Georgia Center of Opportunity, folks who have committed to school reform, committed to prison reform, all folks, but don't necessarily do marches and go out there and do some of that stuff. We're going to do a work session tonight, and we will get results out of that.
Would you say that the marches prompted much of the discussion? People do things in different ways, but many of the marches brought it to, as I said earlier, the level of awareness where we've got to bring it to the head so that people who strategize differently can do it. Before, had the marches not occurred, had the shootings not occurred, I dare say, even though your concern might have been there, but the meeting that would occur tonight possibly might not have occurred.
Well, the students at Morehouse College asked for the meeting.
Okay.
Because
right.
they want to do something that's within their model of leadership.
Okay. Buddy, I know you want to jump in here.
I want to say it's always easy to be a critic, but I think we need to give some special commendation to Mayor Kasim Reed and Chief George Turner, because I think they have been calm. They have been a calming presence. They have shown good leadership here. They've shown the kind of measured response to the situation, and with the help of community leaders like Reverend Durley, I think our situation in Atlanta could have been so much more out of control. So I want to commend our Atlanta leadership.
Absolutely.
On what has taken place right here. I saw, by the way, Mayor Reed on the public news broadcast, News Hour, and I thought he did an excellent job articulating and representing Atlanta. So I think we ought to give credit where credit's due.
Yes.
I do want to turn this conversation to the politics of the moment, which is the presidential campaign. But before I do, let me ask this question of each of you, all of you, whoever wants to answer it. You know, this notion that the movement right now has no, whatever, the Black Lives Matter movement has no strategy, it is amorphous. It's hard for many of us to get our arms around what that's all about. And the comparison between the civil rights movement and this seems hard to make, because we know what the goals were when you were marching for your freedoms, Reverend Durley. We know it was about public accommodations. It was about voting rights. There were very specific goals that you all championed. Saying we need more jobs in the Black community, saying we need police who treat us with respect, those are tough, amorphous kinds of things to strategize around.
Well, I think all of those things add up to one thing. If you had to have a bottom line, there needs to be inherent in all of the messaging a systemic change. Now, that might be as broad as it might sound, but there are different parallels under that. We overall need a systemic change where it comes to the issues around education, when it comes to the issues around access to health care, when it comes to the issues around environmental injustice. Those are the kinds of things, but rather it's hard to for young people, because they are leading this, no doubt about it. So they say we need to have a systemic change where the police are not being brutal, where we get better education, where we get better health care. These are the things that add to that. Now, once the awareness is there and you come down to meetings like Brother Smith was talking about, then we can sit down. What do we do? Who are the people? What buttons do we need to push now? Where are the budgetary kinds of issues and political legislative changes that need to occur in each of those? So I think that right now, when you're hurting, when your head hurts, you might grab your leg. You just know you hurt. You don't even know where. You don't even know why. You just know you hurt. And I think that's the general sentiment right now.
All right. Let me, in fact, Buddy, I'm going to turn to you first, because I think you said an important thing. You said sometimes we have to look beyond politics. We have to rise above politics to look at the larger picture. Yesterday, we heard these inspiring speeches, but they do come in the middle of a presidential campaign. So I'm going to throw out an observation that I'm open to all of you attacking in the fullest way you want to do it. I am not convinced when, after a George W. Bush and a President Obama speak so inspiringly, I turn and look at the two people who are now the presumptive nominees of their parties, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, and I'm not sure that I see in either of them a will to step up as leaders, as inspiring leaders. And let me play you a couple of sound clips that I think Hillary Clinton just gave a speech a couple hours ago, not even that long ago, in Springfield, Illinois. She gave the speech, buddy, in the same location where President Abraham Lincoln gave his speech, a house divided against itself will not stand. Let's listen just to a short minute or so of what she had to say.
Now, I realize that our politics have contributed to the sense of division that many Americans feel right now. And as someone in the middle of a hotly fought political campaign, I cannot stand here and claim that my words and actions haven't sometimes fueled the partisanship that often stands in the way of progress. So I recognize I have to do better too. I'm running for president with the belief that we need to face up to these challenges and fix them in order to become a stronger, fairer country. And in times like these, we need a president who can help pull us together, not split us apart.
And now let's listen briefly to remarks that Donald Trump made just the other night.
The two people that were killed in Louisiana and Minnesota, it was tough. It was tough to watch. We have to figure it out. We have to figure out what's going on. Was it training? Was it something else? It could have been something else. We have to take care of everybody. Remember that. But we can never, ever forget the hundreds of thousands of great deals and great things that our police all over the country do, and nobody recognizes them for what they do. As bad as these two situations were, and I personally think they were bad. I hated watching it. But as bad as they were, they get broadcast all over the world for days and days, and all of the good things, which are magnified thousands of times, nobody talks about. So we have to remember, we have to cherish and take care of our police. If we don't, we don't have a country anymore.
Okay. Do we hear inspiring leadership in either of those candidates?
I think they both sounded very genuine. Hillary Clinton sounded humble to the point of vulnerability, which makes you feel like here's a human person having a connection to the conditions in America and our own complicity in playing up some of the divisiveness. From Donald Trump, you hear a man who sometimes always constructive in the way he looks at things, pragmatic in the way he's so blunt about things, say, we need to fix this, to get right down to the idea that these are not things that sit well with me, that look bad for our country, that people are watching, and we are better America than that, and we need to start looking at the elements that create these kinds of conditions. I think they both sounded great.
Buddy?
As a veteran of 12 campaigns as a candidate, one has to be especially careful to first do no harm and not cross a line. And I think both of the candidates showed what I called a good measured response. There's always a time in which you can be more inspirational. There's always a time in which you can do more nuances. But at the same time, the risk to both candidates is very high here of crossing the line and going too far. Now, they're candidates. They're not the president. They're not George W. Bush. They're not, of course, current President Barack Obama. So they don't have the efficacy. But I thought, concerning the fact that their candidates are in a heated campaign, I would give both of them pretty good marks here for, I think, bringing out the situation as it is today.
Well, it's ironic for two things. Number one, we cut the Hillary Clinton bite a little short just for time's sake so we could talk. After saying that she's guilty sometimes of making the divide worse, she does go on in her comments to be extremely critical, brutal about Donald Trump. And Trump, of course, has he has made some comments. Let's listen to what he said right after the Dallas. I think it was right after Dallas.
I am the law and order candidate. Hillary Clinton, on the other hand, is weak, ineffective, pandering, and as proven by her recent email scandal, she's either a liar or grossly incompetent. One or the other. Very simple. Personally, it's probably both. Wherever Hillary Clinton goes, corruption and scandal follow.
So, Gerald Durley, you know, part of my thought about this, the reason I said I wasn't sure I heard inspiration from anybody is that was Trump's first response to all this, was to really attack Hillary Clinton and to declare himself like a Richard Nixon, I'm the law and order candidate. Hillary Clinton waited so long to give this speech today, I thought, as an observer of all of this. And I wonder if she allowed, Buddy says you got to be careful, you can't overdo it. But I wonder if she allowed Trump to take the field away from her.
No, I don't think so. I think all candidates, and Buddy, I think, was right on point, is that in times like this, you monitor what you say, when you say it, because social media and also political, the broader media can take things and run with it. So I think she deliberately put a proper cadence to what she was saying, how she said it. When Donald Trump made the law and order, it was frightening. It frightened me because we're fighting that. We're trying to pull things back together where one is not a certain candidate doing this, and so emphatically that it was a little frightening in those on those remarks. So I think that it's better, rather than to be have a knee-jerk reaction, take a deep breath, find out what it is, look at your political landscape, as well as what is the inner being saying? What do you really believe? Because that's what people are ready to believe in somebody that's virtuous enough to bring forth a change in the way that we're living, economically, politically, health-wise. And so you take time to think those things through, not a knee-jerk reaction. So I think it was appropriate.
Buddy?
Well, the days of politicians saying one thing to one group and one thing to another group are long, long gone. Yeah. And as Reverend Durley points out, social media, the hidden mic, the off-the-cuff remark that ends up on YouTube, it's a dangerous world out there for a candidate. So you've got to remember, and in particular, you can never bring the words back. I haven't been the greatest fan of Governor Deal, but I think he's done a lot of responsible and good things as governor, including a couple of vetoes you've heard me talk about. But I think he fell into a little trap the other day with his Twitter, and I really don't think he meant and really thought through the fact that it could be misinterpreted.
Just to remind people who might not have seen, those who might not have seen the story, the governor's tweet right after the news of the Dallas shootings came out referred to the demonstration as an anti-police demonstration. He got a lot of flack immediately on Twitter for that, and they withdrew the tweet. He then tried to explain it away, but I'm not sure his explanation satisfied the people who were upset about it.
And you know, back to the electoral politics of what Donald Trump said, I'm not so sure that the audience that listens to Donald Trump and votes for Donald Trump considers what he said, I am the law and order candidate, a negative at all. As a matter of fact, I would even say, as we saw in, say, Savannah, there were many Black American elderly citizens who were like, I am sick and tired of walking on streets where violence is happening, where young people are bumping into me, doing drive-bys, selling drugs in front of my steps. I want a law and order candidate. I think there are many people who resonate with what Donald Trump says, even though it doesn't fit the traditional narratives from the Nixonian period.
So. That's a good point, Leo, but we're not playing just a Peoria these days like Nixon used to talk about.
Yes.
We're playing again to the entire mass of the population, right, both national and even international. So that's the risk that a candidate runs these days.
And then how do you interpret that law and order statement? Because it's even now, it's yes, in Savannah and other places, even in Ferguson and other places, people want law and order. When something comes up, they want the law to come in, but it's how it's met it. And so when a candidate comes out such as, you know, an emphatic way, law and order, it's interpreted or misinterpreted,
right,
that this is, I'm going to lock you up, I'm going to put you down, throw away the key, three strikes and you're out. That's the kind of of attitude that's the way it's interpreted.
All right, I got to take a break. But I do want to say, as we close out this segment, because we're going to move on to the GOP convention, I think you just said, you both, Leo and Reverend Durley, said something really interesting. Law and order. We all want it. And no matter who says it, whether it's Donald Trump or someone more neutral, the big question, and it's the one that in a way our conversation is all about, is law and order for who? Who's law and order? We all deserve it, but that's not the way the country perceives it right now. Fascinating to think about. All right, we've got to take a break. It's 2:31 on Wednesday afternoon. We'll be back. We've got a report from Jim Galloway up there in Cleveland. We're going to talk about the Republican convention and their interesting platform.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal. Your car can make so many sounds: sputtering, backfiring, squeaking, grinding, if it's my car, threats, muttered under its breath. Trade in those sounds for the sounds of public radio. Donating that unwanted car, truck, or even an RV is easy and helps the station in a big way. You may even earn a tax write-off.
Go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR and thanks.
On the next Fresh Air, reflections on being married to a Navy fighter pilot. We talk with Rachel Sarnes. Her new memoir, The War at Home, is about the impact of her husband's long and frequent absences on the marriage and the difficulty she's had maintaining her own identity when his military career has defined so much of their lives. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. At the table with me, former Democratic Congressman Buddy Darden from Cobb County, Leo Smith, the Director of Minority Engagement at the Georgia Republican Party, and the very Reverend Gerald Durley, retired senior pastor of Providence Missionary Baptist Church and one of this city's real pride and joys as a great former civil rights, well, an ongoing civil rights leader, Reverend Durley. You can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. Ted has already done that. He says he was expecting to find fault. I think he's talking about the president's speech, perhaps. There were a few parts I wish he'd save for another time, but I thought the speech was powerful. And we invite you to tweet us as we go through the show today. All right. So the Republicans are up in Cleveland. Leo, you're headed there, I think, tomorrow?
Correct.
To start the activities that will lead to the nomination of Donald Trump. Jim Galloway has been up there all week. He went up to watch the platform committee. And I want to play for you a conversation. He couldn't be with us live because there's a meeting he's got to sit in on. But let's listen to our conversation so you can get a sense of what he sees happening in Cleveland.
I think the importance of this week, it's a chance for the ranking GOP leadership to kind of get comfortable with all the implications of a Donald Trump nominee.
And does it appear that the regulars in the party are beginning to feel okay that they've got Donald Trump as their nominee?
I don't think okay is the word. I think we are in the final stages of grief, and that is acceptance. We've already had 2 days of platform committee meetings. We've got a Republican platform that made several concessions to Donald Trump, particularly on immigration. But it also allowed social conservatives in the Republican Party to really reinforce their grip on the machinery of the GOP, which means if Donald Trump doesn't make it in November, we know who's going to be in charge afterwards.
You mean the social conservatives?
Right. Quite a bit of the action in the platform committee, when it wasn't about immigration and trade policy, which were the two Trump issues, really, it was about gay marriage and abortion, Planned Parenthood. And the LGBT fight got very, very interesting. On Monday, you had a delegate, the first gay delegate to ever sit on the platform committee, openly gay delegate, Rachel Hoff of the District of Columbia. And she proposed just a very, very mild statement that acknowledged that among Republicans, attitudes were changing toward gay marriage. It just put that into the platform as an amendment, completely wiped out, more than a two-thirds vote. Against it. Tuesday, you had a delegate from Rhode Island attempt to add to a very harsh condemnation of Islamic terrorism, of course, in the platform. He wanted to add a line that said the LGBT community has been a specific target of those terroristic was on the month, kind of the one exactly 1 month after the Pulse nightclub shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And that was rejected. What happened was you had other delegates say, we need Jews and Christians who've been targeted by Islamic terrorism too. And they said, okay, let's add that. So you had LGBT, Jews and Christians. No, that still wasn't good. It wasn't good enough until LGBT was erased from that statement.
Yeah.
And they just went with a final statement that said all people have been targeted.
Jim, to the extent that people pay attention to platforms, the move to the right by the platform committee, you imagine will play well in Georgia?
I think it will play well within the base. I think your swing voters in that northern arc, I'm thinking your female GOP voters, your traditional GOP voters, they are not going to want to see that line in the platform that says, we will build a wall that stretches the length of the Mexican border with the U.S.
Interesting. Okay. And what are you hearing about the effort to win over 28 members of the Rules Committee to be able to have an opportunity to change the rules to unbind delegates?
Well, what I'm finding out is that that info that Randy Evans, the RNC member, gave us on the show on Friday, it's still good. The whip count here is maybe there are 18 people, maybe there are 10 swing voters, and anti-Trump forces would have to get all 10 of those voters in order to force a minority report, which would put on the floor the issue of whether delegates have to cast their first vote for the candidate they're pledged to.
Jim Galloway in Cleveland reporting on what he's seeing up there. A lot to unpack there, I think. Leo Smith, I thought his observation was fascinating, that the party is moving into the hands of, once again, we thought this was over with, of the social conservatives. All of the reporting out of Washington suggests that that Tony Perkins, the director of the Family Research Council, an extremely conservative organization, was sitting, writing amendments to the platform and handing them up to the committee, and they were adopting them one after the other. Your thoughts on this?
Well, I don't think that these were more affirmations than any sort of acceptance of any new amendment. I think the things that were affirmed were the Republican platform in general. Social conservatism is still part of the Republican Party, is still a large part of it. We are a center-right country, and our party is a party that is right on the side of politics. You know, to the amendment that was added, the clear language of that on as through all that deliberation about LGBT rights was, we oppose the brutal assault on all human beings, all of whom have inherent
Well, dignity. Yes, but buddy, you heard Jim say that this is kind of like efforts in the Georgia legislature to pass a bullying statute that would include gays and lesbians as part of the language. It'll never go anywhere. So, yes, they passed a broad measure, but they specifically didn't pass it until gays and lesbians came out.
Well, Bill, week after next, whenever the Democratic convention is going to be, that will be the first Democratic convention I've missed since 1984. And I don't know anything I paid less attention to as an elected official or a delegate or merely an attendee than the platform. The platform is something for the activists to get all excited about on both sides. You're going to see the platform on the Republican way to the right. You're going to see the platform on the Democrats way to the left. And what's going to happen in the end is after it's over, the person that wins is going to say, well, I'll choose what part of the platform I want. And the ones who lose say, well, it makes any difference. We lost anyway.
All right. So that said, Reverend Durley, Buddy makes a great point. We know that the platforms are largely ignored, except to this extent. Doesn't a platform tend to send messages to party regulars in individual locations like states and state legislatures? Doesn't it set the table for, in this case, for a Republican legislature here in Georgia to be encouraged to take up measures that act on what the platform states?
Well, I think the base right now, we've talked about that little narrow group of independents. The bases are set in both groups. And they're just tying in the Bernie Sanders people. We'd be moving in the Hillary Clinton camps, regardless of those different issues, regardless of the differences. And those, and right now, I think that many of them are moving toward being Trumpicized, if you will, into that whole base. So that's not going to make a big difference. As Buddy said, a few little, we call them sound bites, and we all know how to throw a sound bite out to to get it. So I don't think that it's going to make that big a difference when it comes down, because it's pretty set. There's a small group of independents, but I think the bases are set. Whether it's, they put in lesbianism or whether they put in immigration, they know where the candidates are. And I'd like to get Leo's thinking on that, because I think the one side of the party is pretty much set where it's going to be headed from the Clinton, Bernie Sanders side, but from the Republican side, it's still kind of challenging which words to put in there to be politically accurate, even though the candidate says I would not be politically accurate.
Yeah, I think that where people are politically with platforms is really a sign of the times. There's a lot of unrest by people who are saying, what is America? What are our value systems? That's a real question. 30% of Republicans have a lot of angst about Donald Trump and whether or not he will impact our platform in a real way. The fact is this is all good for robust debate about who we are, where we are politically. Yeah. When I watch Hillary Clinton stand next to Bernie Sanders as Bernie Sanders talked about the movement will continue, Hillary didn't look all that happy. She looked like she was tolerating it. The corners of her mouth were turned downward. She was tolerating listening to this, saying, I hope I don't have to deal with this for a long time. But the fact is that Bernie's ideology has moved the Democrat Party even further left.
Which is why Buddy suggests that the Democratic platform is going to be a document perhaps as far to the left as the Republican platform is to the right. But let me ask you, Leo, before we take our final break of the show, it does appear, based on Jim's reporting, that the final effort to try to stop Trump, which would be to pass a rule that the convention could then vote on that would unbind delegates and therefore allow voters who are bound to delegates who are bound to Trump to vote for whoever they like, it looks like that's not going to happen, and that any effort to defeat Trump, he's your nominee. Yes?
The coup d'etat doesn't look like it's going to happen. And that's just the fact. It's always been very difficult. I mean, even when you saw delegates who were affidavited on, say, a Trump vote, but then they didn't like it. And then in some states, they even switched before they got to convention. They said, well, you're a Rubio delegate. I'm a Trump delegate. Can we switch so we can vote the way we feel? That kind of stuff was happening as well, even while the Never Trump thing was happening. It basically killed it.
All right. Before we take our break, and as long as we're talking Republican politics, I want to get you all to weigh in on this. Boys, you know, notorious Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she really went out on a limb, as we know this week. She basically said she attacked Donald Trump rather aggressively, said, you know, jokingly, she and her husband were going to her husband had always said, we're going to leave the country at some point if the wrong president comes along. She said she can't imagine a country with him in charge. And Trump fired back at her the way he fired back at the Pope. No respect. He basically said she was old. He really ought to just quit. Yeah, Gerald Durley, what the heck?
Well, I thought that those persons who elected to the Supreme Court are elected to tell the truth.
There's a little difference between truth and opinion.
Yeah. Well, from her, but that was her truth. As far as and you have to respect a person regardless of where they come down. One might say, I believe in the cross burning. That's their opinion, and it's her opinion, but she believed that so strongly. And as a you want when people are making decisions as high as the Supreme Court to really voice their opinion.
Well, but she's had very few defenders on either side of the aisle on this one.
I was somewhat amused by the whole episode, because I didn't realize that you could offend Donald Trump at all. And I think his pretending to be offended is somewhat humorous.
Wait, are you kidding? Everything that isn't worshipful offends Donald Trump.
It offends him, but I will point out to you, and that's Justice Alito sitting right there at the State of the Union when President Obama made a statement, then he mouthed back, that's not right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's always, this is not a case of first impression.
Well, there is a practical side to this, Leo. Should this end up, as the year 2000 did, in the Supreme Court, the outcome of the election, or should she be on the court when a potential President Trump administration brings a case before the court? It really does raise questions as to whether she needs to recuse herself, because she's really shown her hand on Donald Trump.
I think, as you said, I think there are people who understand constitutional law and the responsibility to a high standard of ethics that is for the Supreme Court. They would make that argument.
Of course, you could also say that in 2000, the court made a pretty definitive political statement when it stopped the recount in Florida dead in its tracks and gave the election to George W. Bush.
And Ruth Bader Ginsburg would be the one who decides whether or not she's recused. Right. And I can assure you that she will stay on and make whatever ruling she thinks appropriate.
Perhaps she can have a meeting on a runway in two airplanes.
Oh, all right. I somehow think, Leo, we're going to hear about that at the GOP convention next week. Let's take our final break of the show. When we come back, you've already referred to Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Let's talk about that, what did seem to be a rather awkward staging of an endorsement yesterday. This is Political Rewind. It's 2:46. We'll be back in a moment.
On Monday, Republicans will convene in Cleveland to nominate Donald Trump for president. NPR and PBS NewsHour will be there, too. We're teaming up to bring you live coverage each night. I'm Rachel Martin. Join me, Judy Woodruff, and Gwen Ifill for speeches, interviews, and analysis live from the Republican National Convention. Special coverage from PBS NewsHour and NPR News.
Join us Monday through Thursday evening from 8 to 11 here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Reverend Gerald Durley, Republican Leo Smith, Democrat Buddy Darden at the table in the studio, the Political Rewind studio today. Having just heard that stirring promotion for NPR's coverage of the conventions, it's a good opportunity for me to just take a moment to tell you that we're expanding Political Rewind for both the Republican and Democratic convention weeks because we think you're interested. We hope you are. We certainly are. So next week, we're going to be on the air live at 2 o'clock on Tuesday. We'll be in our regular time slot, 2 o'clock on Wednesday, and then come back with our show at 3 on Friday because we really do think there's enough going on that you ought to hear from us. We're working right now. Producer Trevor Young has been lining up guests from Cleveland that we're going to be talking to. We'll have some of our regular panelists in here. We'll play plenty of sound of what's happening every night. So I hope you join us for our expanded coverage of the convention. All right, Buddy Darden. You're a big Hillary supporter. But before we talk about your support for her, let's talk about the person who staged this endorsement yesterday. You had, if you don't mind my calling her, poor Hillary Clinton, standing behind Bernie Sanders for the entirety of what was the most lukewarm endorsement I think you could ask a candidate to make. She looked just so awkward. She should never have had to stand. They should have brought her out. Beyond everything else, the stage dynamics weren't good, buddy.
That's the price you pay for being the candidate, and that's the price you pay for peace in the family. I remember seeing Chris Christie looking at Donald Trump. It reminded me a little bit of that.
Right.
And in any event, Hillary knows how to be a leader but also a good soldier, and sometimes you just have to sit there and take it. And she had to sit there and take it while he raved on and on about how great he was.
Well, that was what was so kind of amusing. I guess he has the right to take, you know, you sort of say he gets a victory lap, except he lost. And yet he spent an awful lot of time talking about all the delegates he won. And he kind of begrudgingly admitted that she'd won about 248 more delegates. And, of course, she had all those superdelegates who he thought were awful to begin with. Is this endorsement going to truly work? And are those Bernie Sanders folks going to come to Hillary, Gerald?
I think so. And one of the things I learned, you know, having grown up on the West Coast and then in Denver, Colorado, they say that if you chase a coyote into a corner, you can run and they'll run all over the prairie, but if you chase them into a cave with only one exit, do not run in there. They give them a way out. She gave Bernie a beautiful way out. He came out, she stood there, and as Buddy said, the family is together. And I think by people seeing that, she's standing there in the manner in which she did, it lets them know that she is the kind of person that is conciliatory for them, for us all to come together, for people to come together. I think it's going to play very well.
He says he will be out there campaigning for her, that he'll travel all over the country.
But he had to get that out first. You have to, once you've been in the trenches and you've got mud, you've got to get the mud off. You got to clean up your shirt before you can start. He had to get all of that out of his system.
Yeah. Well, you know, except that the big question for Hillary Clinton's campaign now, buddy, is fine, he'll go out and speak on her behalf. Is he going to turn over his formidable email list, his social media list, so that she can really take advantage of the extraordinary database that he built throughout his campaign? That's what matters.
Well, they know who they are. And the bottom line, quite candidly, Bill, is if you're for Bernie Sanders, what are your choices? You can either go along with Hillary Clinton or vote for Donald Trump. It's just like the same thing that the Republicans are faced with. It's either Trump or Hillary. Which do you detest the most? The Sanders people detest Trump a whole lot more than they dislike Hillary. And it's the same thing on the other side. So I don't see any problem, frankly, with the vast majority of the Sanders supporters coming into, even though it might be reluctantly, not as enthusiastically, but clearly into the Clinton camp.
Yeah, Leo, the polling by several news organizations on this, or polling organizations, suggests that around 78% to 85% of Sanders people say they will now vote for Hillary Clinton. What do you think of that?
Well, I like the fact that it's only 75% to 85%. That's a 25% availability for Donald Trump. And, you know, and the other thing I would say, I mean, the way that Hillary Clinton looked, I'm thinking about investing in Tums.
Well, let me say this as a candidate who only had to do that one time. And Johnny Isaacson and I spoke about this time at length one time. He had to endorse a candidate who was reprehensible to him, who had beat him in a primary. And I had to do the same thing. And it's tough. It hurts. It will make you sick at your stomach, I promise you.
The energy, here's the challenge for the Democrats. The energy of their party is Bernie Sanders.
But that's transferable energy, I believe. And I believe that he'll be in there working along with her, along with it. And I've just like Buddy was saying, I remember when I retired and I had to bring in a younger person. And I had to stand behind him and say, this is the person. But inside of me, I was saying, there's something else I want to do. I want to make sure that we're still out in the streets. But his whole thing, we're moving toward another direction right now. So I had to just stand there after 30 or so years, and I think that that's the role. And now what has happened, the entire congregation is going in one direction. And I, you give that, but I had to stand there and endorse, even though, and I think it's the same kind of thing. And I think that that's what's going to happen. And I didn't even need Tums.
Well, I will point out one last note about poor Bernie Sanders. You know, we all been watching the remarkable turn of events in Great Britain, and especially the fact that David Cameron, like in a matter of a day, has to pack up and leave 10 Downing Street because the new PM is going to be moving in. I was struck by the fact the other night that the Secret Service announced, Bernie, after tonight, we're out of here. That really tells you when your campaign is over, when the Secret Service packs up its bags and leaves you behind.
I think he's got a movement that's going to last. It's going to be here to deal with for quite a while.
Okay, well,
I think that's positive, though. That's positive. That's the checks and balances, because he's made us all think about different directions and move in different ways. And I think that's what America is really about, when you can have those divergent opinions and you can still pull and tug and move toward the overall good for the nation.
Okay, so go ahead, buddy.
Before we leave today, I want to send special congratulations to Reverend Sharma Lewis of Atlanta, who has been elected as the first African-American woman bishop of the United Methodist Church.
Yeah.
And I think that's a great step forward for the Methodist Church and a great step forward for Atlanta.
Well, thank you for saying any other good and welfare we need to address while we're here. Let me talk quickly about the polling. I think we know by now that paying too much attention to the, you know, it really is like an addiction. We all say we know it's bad for us. We know the polling day to day, week to week, at this point, still doesn't mean a whole lot, and yet we can't help ourselves. So with that in mind, Leo, it is remarkable, two developments. One, a number of polls now have Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump virtually tied, or Trump a little ahead, except within the margin of error, in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Florida, three key swing states. And in the aftermath of Jim Comey's remarkable statement about Mrs. Clinton, the trust factor, the believability factor right now is higher for Donald Trump than Hillary Clinton.
Yes, this bodes well, very well, for the Donald Trump campaign, especially since he's only just now begun to do fundraising. And we saw great fundraising numbers out of him in June. He's been incredibly behind her. But now that he has the ability to do ads, now that we're going to Cleveland and we will begin to mobilize people at the ground level in every state, we have media surrogates going out speaking with him and for him. This does not look good for the Democrat Party, because now you've got a situation where you've been running, you know, full speed, a half lap ahead on the track, and we're even.
On the other hand, buddy, when you look at demographics, this is just so difficult to see Trump find a way to get through. Women are absolutely not, you know, most women just say no to Donald Trump. African-Americans, obviously. You know, Leo Smith has said over and over he's going to get 25% of the black vote in Georgia. I find that really hard to imagine.
Did he? Was that a quote from Leo?
Leo Smith
was 20% was a quote, and we've got a bet.
He's got a bet with Jim Galloway on this.
Well, I'll be interested. I'd like to hold the money for those two. But I would point out that I do think the worst part of the Clinton email business is over. And as a former district attorney, I'm telling you that if carelessness were a crime, we'd all be in jail at one time or another.
Do you honestly...
I honestly believe she's not guilty of any crime. I think that she should have known better. However, Bill, I wrote you one time, and I looked in. You had three email addresses. And so this is things that happened. She was careless. She should not have had this to happen. But at the same time, we all make mistakes. And if you went to jail for mistakes, we'd all be in
Well, no, my question for you is going to be, and then, well, Leo, go ahead.
Well, I want to ask, you know, I don't get the time to sit at the foot of people who, you know, I've admired some of their work, and Reverend Darley, you know, Hillary Clinton is polled by some of those same pollsters as only having between 85% and 89% of the black vote support right
sure.
now. Mm-hmm. That's lower than any Democrat president candidate that we've seen in a long time. What do you think of that?
No, I think, again, we go back to the polling situation, but I think as it begins to unfold and the real questions about who can govern the country more appropriately in terms of, it's always been, as you notice, black folks are concerned, who is the group that best meets our needs? And that will be more definitive, I think, as the discussions begin to go on in terms of education, in terms of health care, in terms of economic development. As those defining lines begin to go, then I think you'll see those figures
All
begin
right.
to increase.
We are completely out of time. Reverend Gerald Durley, thank you so much. Leo Smith, always great. Have fun in Cleveland. We'll talk to you when you're up there. And Buddy Darden, thank you for being back at the table. I'm Bill Nigut. My thanks to our producer, Trevor Young, our senior producer, Jenny Amond, Caroline Hayes, and Hannah Rose Adams, our interns. We'll see you again here at 3 o'clock on Friday afternoon for Political Rewind.
Hey, Leo.